friends, welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Cole Hornaday.
Hey.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And joining us again is John Boylan.
Hello.
Hey. All right. And we are still sitting like we are interviewing you for a job.
We're still assessing.
What
still evaluating.
What are you looking for?
Yeah, job. Exactly. What's your biggest weakness?
Where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Where do I
start? All right. So I came across this article recently from TheGuardian.com, where they talked about how Charlie Adlard became the new Comics Laureate in the UK. And I guess the role of the Comics Laureate is just to, like, raise awareness of comics.
Like an ambassador?
Yeah, he's an ambassador. Okay.
Maybe like a literary.
It's not a recognition of the triumph of your work the way a poet laureate is?
I don't know.
You know, because, you know, what Bob Dylan, didn't we not make Bob Dylan
Well, he just won a Pulitzer Prize for literature.
Okay, all right.
Which he's refusing to acknowledge. Himself.
Oh, is that right?
Well, okay. You know, the story goes that the Pulitzer Committee could not get a hold of him because, yes. I guess, you know, he's unlisted in the phone book. And then it came out that he's not going to fly to, I think it's Switzerland or Prague to pick up his award.
All right, so let's try this. The late Leonard Cohen was Poet Laureate of Canada.
Okay.
Which to me meant that his work stood out as inspiration to other poets and, you know, people of the world. So I'm a little bit, I had never heard the term comic book laureate before.
I think it's a new thing. He's only the second one.
Because Charlie Adlard, of all people, I mean, he does good work, but it's not groundbreaking. I mean,
Dave Gibbons is the previous.
Dave Gibbons, for sure.
It says here from the article, the role is intended to raise awareness of the impact comics can have in terms of increasing literacy and creativity.
Okay.
And can go to a creator, writer, or artist.
So Dave Gibbons, through his work with Watchmen and the graphic novels he's done, but Adlard, you know, I just think of Walking Dead because that's what he's done for the last 20 plus years.
Don't forget that run of X-Files.
I was
going to
say that run of X-Files wasn't too shabby. Yeah.
It doesn't say like why they picked him. I don't think they needed they liked him. Yeah. And
he's prolific and he's sturdy and he's stalwart and he's reliable and he's British. Yes.
Yes. He's the artist for Walking Dead. Is that right?
Yeah. He has been since like the third or fourth issue.
I thought after the first story arc, so...
Okay. I think so, after the first
Tony
volume,
Moore
right?
Tony Moore is all volume one.
Yeah, because Tony Moore tried to sue...
I thought it was Terry.
Tony
Moore. No, it's Tony. Yeah.
That's where I get confused.
Yeah. Terry is
Rosie Knows.
Strangers in Paradise.
Yeah, Rosie Button Noses.
Yeah.
So,
anyway.
I mean, he's
geek muttering.
He's delighted and deeply honored to be the appointee. This is a quote, the power of comics to encourage learning and develop literacy shouldn't be underestimated. Comics can connect with people who may never pick up a normal book and really help encourage a love of reading. I see this as a great opportunity to bring the wonder of comics to a wider audience. He says earlier in the article that his son is dyslexic, and one of the few things his son actually will read completely is a comic book.
Got it.
And so it's one of his ways to connect, and it's one of the son's ways to connect to literature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It gives you a visual context of what you're actually reading.
Yeah,
which is why it's great for reading comprehension and literacy, and I think didn't you learn a lot from reading comics when you were a kid because of the visual stuff?
I had a reading disability.
Yeah.
So this was the only way my mother could get me to bother. It's a great source just to get kids interested in trying to read.
I guess that's something that a lot of people, especially parents, don't realize because they kind of I'm not a parent, but I am always under this impression that comics have. That they're sort of like the junk food of the reading world.
Right.
You know? And they're not, but they can be a very valuable main course.
I well, think, Oh.
Go, no, you're good.
I think with like Scholastic being in schools and things like Smile and Drama and Sisters all coming out and Bone and Amulet, I think that it's bringing it to another level for parents, that they're realizing that their kids are becoming more voracious readers because they're picking up these books. And I'm finding people coming into the store and saying, you know, I've heard from other parents that, you know, kids can, you know, they're better readers when they get into comic books. And I'm like, I hear that time and time again. Yeah. So I think it's starting to spread, at least in progressive Seattle, so I'm not really sure what it looks like at other places.
Well, you know, that stigma about comic books being literary junk food or corrupting your minds, that goes back to the 1950s and that whole Red Scare period, which my personal theory, and I'm sure it's shared with others, is that whole Seduction of the Innocent period and all that stuff set the whole art form back. Chronologically, culturally, and I often wonder what comic book culture would look like had not that stuff happened. Because, you know, now there's becomes a sort of generational gradual growing of approval. You know, as comics being literary works, mm-hmm. starting in the 80s. But my goodness, what the culture might look like if had we not had all that folderol from the 50s.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, I mean, it would look different. I don't know if it would be. I mean, if comics would be considered big, legitimate literary art forms uh-huh. before they were accepted as such. I mean, we got a lot of great underground comics
right.
during that time. And so the landscape is different, you know. I don't know. It's hard to imagine it being in a more progressive place than it is now earlier.
Well,
what I'm trying to say? I don't.
Yeah, okay. Well, I point fingers. I direct your attention to the, you know, the Belgian artists, Hergé, and people that were developing their work in the 50s and 60s, and the French illustrators like Jean-Gerard Mobius, manga, and books that, in a lot of ways, or not books, but cultures that in a lot of ways, you know, moved ahead as far as the maturity of their storytelling was concerned culturally. John?
Yeah.
What do you think?
John's on board.
He's smiling and nodding at me like, don't smile and nod at me.
Something else that Charlie Adlard, I feel like I should just call him by his first name. Charlie, you know, Chuck.
I think he prefers Chuck, even though Chuck. He's Brit. Right. Yeah.
Something else he says in the article is that he abhors the phrase graphic novel.
Right.
Because comics, because there's that whole dichotomy of, you know, comics are for kids mm-hmm. and graphic novels are for adults. Even mm-hmm. though we've already discussed, graphic novel is a legitimate, like, trade term.
Mm-hmm.
It's a technical term.
Yeah, see, that's where that sounds like he's mad at an old joke. Like, I remember, like, Mr. Science Theater.
Old man shakes fists at sky.
Yeah.
I remember this one you're talking about.
Mr. Science Theater, where it's just like...
I had a graphic novel over there.
Or the scene, like, giant mansion, and it's like, Wayne Manor. And it's like, oh, is that just like in the comics? And the robot's like, it's not a comic, it's a graphic novel. Right. And it's just like,
I thought
we were past that point of people being that uppity of trying to determine if it's that. Because it is a novel that is graphic.
Yeah.
It is a
graphic
official...
as in pictures, not graphic as in gore, violence, and right. naughty bits.
Yeah. Visual graphic.
Naughty explicit. Bits.
When I'm looking through my order form, it really does help me to see TP or GN, because then I know that I should order more of the GN because it's never existed before.
Right.
So when somebody like him starts complaining about that, a man who was in the industry, I'm a little worried.
Yeah.
I don't think you understand some of this.
It must just be because he's still hearing it from people. The stigma of people like not, you know.
I think it's also a cultural distinction, because he's a Brit, and we're talking about American distinctions. And this was something that I talked with Marjan Satrapi about years ago, the woman who wrote.
Here, let me pick up that name you just dropped.
Okay. Kind of heavy, wasn't it? Kind of left a red mark in your hands and you took a grip on, didn't you?
I'm sorry. Go on.
Oh no, Ben! I think you closed the chapter on that one. We had this conversation about because she was actually found the term graphic novel to be offensive to an artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because she see this is actually a legit thing to talk about here. It's not just name dropping, buddy.
You are not gonna let that go.
No, I'm really not.
All right.
But yeah, she because she saw a lot of, you know, the bourgeoisie and sort of diminishing that work and trying to create this distinction where there need not be one. And that was very offensive to her.
It sounds like the graphic novel is a technical term, but it also sounds like it's both. It's a technical term and it is
a divisive
descriptor.
I think her argument was it's the term that makes this artwork palatable to a certain stratum of society, and that is a disservice to the work.
Yeah, and it's not like not everybody knows that there is a difference between a comic and a graphic novel. I didn't, certainly for the longest time. I just thought graphic novel was what you called comics that you read as an adult, you know, and which plays completely into what Chuck. Is
yeah, don't get too formal. Right. Well, yeah, and I think. Oh, so good. Go ahead.
You,
you, me.
You, yeah, yeah. I'm just having like nightmares of the catalogs having to be redone if somebody tries to change it.
Yeah.
You know, just like,
yeah.
Well, and what else are you gonna call it?
And if they were redone, how would that screw up the way you do things? It would make distinguishing. How you sell stuff. Too far from the microphone. Would it make distinguishing how you label stuff for folks?
Well, yeah. Here's an example. Let's say Avengers has come out with 6 issues, and now it's a trade paperback. And then Amulet comes out with a new volume, and it's only released as a book. Mm-hmm. They would both be considered graphic novels, but then you'd be like, is that an Avenger? Is that the current series of Avenger? Okay. Or is that, you know, whatever. So the distinction helps as far as that is concerned.
It helps clerks manage to get it to the reader.
Okay. Yeah.
At the very least.
At the very, very least.
Because they don't expect customers to be able to make the differentiation.
I think that trade paperback and graphic novel is very interchangeable because it's still a book form and they tend to be used simultaneously.
Yeah. To give you one quick last example on it is it happens almost exclusively with The Walking Dead. But more often than not, I have people coming in and they're like, yeah, is the new issue of Walking Dead out? And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's over here. And I go point them to the single issue and they're like, oh, that's not what I want. I'm like, do you want the trade paperback? They're like, no, I want the comic. I'm like,
so yeah, that happens a lot.
Do you want the big one? And they're like, no, I want the small one. I'm like, okay, there's 5 formats of Walking Dead, hardcover, small cover. So it turns into this thing of just like, no, I know exactly what you want, but now you don't know what you want. And now we're cross confused on who wants what. And so finally you're like, yeah, it was the goddamn trade paperback.
Yeah,
sorry, bleep me. Go ahead, bleep me. But it's just like after a while, and it's just like, and then, you know, you leave it at that point where you're not, you don't get smarmy with the customer. But at the same point, it's just like, I knew what you wanted.
Yeah. A lot of times someone says, I like the issue of or something. I'm like, oh, do you mean the book? You know, and when I put it in that term, then they're like, yes, the book. And then I go to the books. You know, the bound collections, and then distinguish from there, you know, because some people only read it in trade, so they don't know that floppies necessarily
exist. I was going to say, and then do you confuse them by saying, this is a floppy! This is a floppy!
I try to throw some terminology, but not by flapping it in their face and screaming at them, because I do understand that our language in the comic book world is fairly unique, you know, and not easy to navigate because I was once there.
You know, sometimes violence is a legitimate teaching tool.
It just sounds like
it just is sort of off-putting as far as making money off of people.
This is a floppy. This is a floppy.
You use the violence, you knock them out, you take the money.
Oh.
It just sounds like Charlie needs to work in a retail store.
Yeah.
No.
He needs to be down the trenches for a while. In the shops.
In the shops.
He needs to work in the shops.
Down shop. All right. Let's move on, and this is actually a topic that I got from the comic book subreddit. It was a question that was posed to that community, and it was basically called Unfixable. And the poster wants to know, are there any characters out there who have been irreparably ruined by extremely bad writing or storytelling? Like, so-and-so, some character was great, and then somebody got their hands on him, and now you can't do anything else with that character because they've been ruined.
Isn't that like the new 52?
Isn't that like
in
Bendis too?
Yeah.
Isn't that like Bendis in some of the runs? Didn't he ruin some things? And
but particular
is a Sentry?
Characters.
There was something with Sentry, right?
Well, the Sentry for me. Yeah. Actually,
I really liked that character Once Upon a Time.
No, I did. The original story by Sentry. Paul Jenkins and Jay Lee with some guest artists in the middle.
The forgotten Marvel Golden Age superhero. I was fascinated.
Was
with
a
that.
Really cool. Kind of cautionary tale, and it also was like a example of like this is why there should never be a Superman in the Marvel universe. And so it was done in one character's kind of retired at the end of the story, and it's just like that was really enriching. And then they kind of force it to come back, and Brian Michael Bendis is like, let's put him in the Avengers, they need a Superman, and it's like you didn't get the point of the story. Same thing with Brian K. Vaughan's The Hood. He created a villain who was basically just a idiot thug on the street who happened by a magical hood of ultimate power, and he became like the new kingpin. It was a done-in-one short series by Brian K. Vaughan, writer of Saga. It was very entertaining. And then Brian Michael Bendis decided, like, let's make this guy the regular villain for about 10 years. And
Bendis!
I don't want that.
So it just sounds like whatever Brian Michael Bendis gets his hands on.
Not yes. always.
Not always. It's just that he
made
likes
Miles.
To take other people's
He's got Riri.
Really good ideas
yeah.
and run them into the ground.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Not on purpose. You know, I'm sure Frank Miller really thought he was doing Will Eisner a solid with the Spirit movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, the road to hell.
I had a good one this afternoon, and I was hoping that the longer I let you talk, I would remember.
Not there yet?
Yeah, nope. Keep rolling.
Got another one. Gwen Stacy's kind of ruined for me.
No, jeez.
Oh, yeah. No kidding.
And it's just the clones. They kept cloning her again and again
oh,
and again.
Oh, right, yeah.
So it's just like, just leave her dead. Just anytime they have to resurrect a character, Captain Marvel... the original Captain Marvel has lost a lot of steam for me because they kind of resurrected him, but then he was a Skrull. Just like, no,
Mar-Vell. Yeah.
And actually, Carol, I'm tired
I did not mind that Skrull story because it had a lot of charm. So we're talking about Mar-Vell that was created by Jim Starlin back in the 70s, and he died of... He was one of the first characters in the Marvel Universe to actually die of a normal disease. He died of cancer, and it was the very first Marvel graphic novel, and it was called The Death of Captain Marvel. And it was actually... I think it was the first time I ever... wept real tears reading a comic book.
It's a great story.
It was a really good story.
And they
kept him dead. Mm-hmm. However, and that was like 1985, 1986. It was a while ago.
All back then.
But then this was post invasion? Civil War? It was
it
the Skrull
was
thing.
During Civil War, Secret Invasion stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then he just sort of appears, and we knew there were a lot of Skrull clone or Skrull impersonators who were so successfully brainwashed that they believed they were actually these characters, and we believed they were these characters. Well, this Captain Marvel character shows up, and he really does indeed believe he's Captain Marvel, and I actually believed it too until we get to the very end. But the thing is, in being brainwashed to believe he's Mar-Vell, he does a lot of good in the world, even though he's a Skrull. I'm like, that's a good story.
Yeah, it was Paul Jenkins, I think, who did that
one. No, look, Paul. Fadu.
Yeah. I find...
Go
ahead.
No, I just find that in a lot of, like, mainstream stuff, you might get really, really bad runs and really, really bad writers on things. And then, like, somebody great will come in, like Jeff Parker, and he'll make something, like, really amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, bring characters in or create new characters that you'll never hear from again. And, you know, that kind of thing.
I think more often than not, characters can mostly be redeemed.
Yeah.
You just kind of got to let the time cycle flip over and... get away with the disappointment of what happened so badly to them at a certain arc.
Heal your wounds.
Yeah. Well, Jeff Parker on Atlas.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know? Yeah, that was great.
He took all these, like, these forgotten 1950s era characters and put them together in this really interesting group, redeemed a boatload of racist Golden Age garbage and turned it around, and then it just fell apart. It was really sad. I loved those stories.
Mm-hmm.
Atlas, Agents of Atlas.
And now Ken Hale, fun fact, is in Deadpool Mercs for Money and the Mercs for Money. I don't know.
You know
there's
I'm not
going to
get near that. You know I'm not going to get near
but
that.
But my husband did because he is a big Ken Hale fan.
Right. Ken Hale is Gorilla Man, right?
Yeah, he's a Gorilla Man.
You know, I'm not going to touch that.
That's fine. I'm just letting you know.
I'm grumpy about that
It's a
stuff.
Thing that's happening.
Yeah, if it's Deadpool.
This is sadly like mostly in Marvel's camp for me right now, but Squadron Supreme.
No.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah, my favorite team book. Yeah.
It's irreparable, right?
It's irreparable for me. At this moment, I just don't ever want to look at a Squadron Supreme again.
Well, irregardless of how never mind.
Irredeemable.
So Cole, did you come up with who you
I
were trying to think of?
You know, I hold fast to the notion that sometimes a creator will come up with a character that, you know, is genuinely of their own inspiration and no one else can touch it. We covered that in the Howard the Duck episode. And I feel the same way about Man-Thing, though Gerber didn't create Man-Thing. That was Gray Morrow and John, do you remember?
No, Morrow's the only name.
Gray Morrow and Roy Thomas. They created the character. But Gerber's the one who did some really funky things with it. But you know that character has never ever worked since.
Yeah,
he's always just been this bizarre kind of not throwaway character, but he's more a reactionary character that's about the things that happen around him, and no one's been able to find a mode in which to use Man-Thing. I'm hopeful, but I'm dubious at the same time.
When a character gets ruined, like what we've been talking about, and some other creator takes over this character, do they just treat it as a clean slate? Do creators try to like fix what's been done in the past?
Even worse, sometimes when the writer leaves the book, he will leave a royal quagmire for the coming creative team, and that happens a lot.
There was a game on Daredevil about like what kind of horrible situation can you leave the character in for the next arc, but there was a really great one where after they resurrected the Punisher after killing him, they turned him into an agent of heaven and he hunted down demons. Garth Ennis had to take over, and Garth Ennis was just like, I ain't dealing with that. So he literally just started the next run with just the Punisher being like, yeah, work for heaven. Didn't care for it. Going back to job. And they just starts, and they never explain how they undo that last run.
Yeah.
But like
great.
He acknowledged it.
Yeah.
But I just thought of something. So this is a different media flip on it. But I watched the first season of Arrow. And I was kind of liking it for the first chunk. And the Huntress started showing up. I'm like, oh, okay, you're stealing more Batman characters. Mm-hmm. And she was okay. And then they did this arc where she just straight up kills cops. And like she was killing goons. And I have trouble with killing thugs because just like, you don't know, they may have had money troubles and just had to get a job with a local crime lord. But
just one last hit and then they're out of the
right,
medical
right.
bills.
They had four kids. You didn't have to shoot an arrow through his head. So they, but then like she straight up went after cops. And it's just like, well, no. So, and then they turned Arrow into like the White Knight who has to save and redeem her. I was like, I hate both of you now. So like the specific to the Arrow version of those characters that were interestingly written to begin with, then they just fell right on their faces and I hate them completely. So
I have a question.
Yeah.
What about writers or artists that have come onto a title and been so bad that like you didn't actually want to read any other projects by them? Has any of that happened where you've tried somebody and been like, nope?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Can't think of it off the top of my head, but
early era Mark Millar.
Yeah.
You know, there was.
I'm not so troubled by Mark Millar.
No, not like him now. But there was a huge, like, I don't know if it's like 5 to 10 year chunk of time there, though, where the moment I knew he was doing something, I was like, well, that's unreadable. art-wise, Greg Land.
Oh, yeah.
There are runs of books that I actually feel like were stolen from me. Because like he was doing a chunk of the Mighty Avengers with Al Ewing, who I think is like the next big best thing Marvel could ever hope to ever have.
I hope so.
But like the first 5 or 6 issues of that are all Greg Land, and my eyes bleed when I look at it.
You know what?
His artwork they all look like pinups.
They are because he traced them.
He's
a tracer.
He's like
from porn.
Yeah,
and from himself again.
Yes,
yeah.
So.
But you know what? Al Ewan's got this string of like things happening because on the Ultimates, the fill-in artist after Rockefort is some guy named Morissette, and it's like sloppy and cartoony and swirly and just bad. It's just like, do you hate Al Ewing? Like, he's doing some of the best work right now and you're just doing this. And then you take Rockefeller off to do a stupid event again because the Inhumans and the X-Men have to fight for some reason. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, don't you understand that this is our life's blood? Do you not see
support
that I bleed?
The Ewing.
Yeah, so come on, support the Al Ewing. It's just no fair.
So one last question before we move on to book report. And this is actually just for Cole because...
What? What did I do this time?
I know you have... There's no love lost between you and Deadpool. You brought up Deadpool earlier. And so my question to you is there an author... who, if they went on to Deadpool, would you read Deadpool?
That's a good question. That's an awesome question, Ben. And
I can open this up to anybody. If there's like a title you hate, but if somebody started writing...
Actually, that's a great question. It's like, would you feel a bit different? I was going to say something like, put G. Willow Wilson on Deadpool. I want to see what happens.
Okay.
You know, I want someone who has some heart. Now, I totally understand that... The things that I don't get about Deadpool and the reasons why I don't like Deadpool are probably, and then the reasons why people like it are things I probably clearly miss just because I shut down, you know, and I may just also be practicing a great deal of bigotry about the book. And, you know, but so far no one's brought me on bended knee a Deadpool book and said, yeah, Sarah, read, appreciate.
I swear by the moon and the stars in the sky. Yeah, it's going to happen one day.
And lo, the doors will be opened for you.
Well, Gail Simone did a run, right?
Yeah, Gail Simone's run is really great.
There's been a lot of...
See, just never been a big... I think she's really overrated, so...
There are periods of her I do believe are very overrated.
But, you know, maybe I should just, like... Go to the local public library, get some Deadpools, read them, and get over it, you know. But, you know, then I won't have anything to crab about, and I won't be interesting
crossed.
To listen to anymore.
There's Avatar.
Oh, there's always Cross. Yeah.
There'll always be Avatar Publishing.
But, yeah, I would like, so, you know, I would like to see what, someone with that sense of humor, but with some kindness.
Patton Oswalt.
What's that?
Patton Oswalt.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds like a marvelous idea.
Because he did the Justice League story that is one of the greatest.
Yeah,
Justice
I love
League
that.
Stories.
You know, I came across that one like in a junk bin.
Yeah, welcome to the work week.
Yeah. And I just thought that is the sweetest story. Yep.
All right, I'm going to clip this little segment out and send it to Patton. Maybe we can get him to, to do
I mean,
a
they got Brian
Deadpool.
Posehn, and they're like total nerd bros.
Yeah,
so.
Man. Mm-hmm. All right. So I only asked that of Cole because I know that Cole hates
Deadpool. This is going to set him off.
You two don't actually talk about specific characters that you don't read. They're like titles you don't like that I know of or authors. But are there any characters that you just, I cannot, like what? Who's your Deadpool, Chris?
I don't know if I have one. I have to think about that. I mean, I hate the Scarlet Spider, who was Spider-Man's clone.
All right.
But I don't think
again,
that
needed... Again,
yeah, it was
the clone!
Yeah,
man.
Dude, you don't realize how much the clones, like, engulfed all of comicdom a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
it was terrible.
I can't. That's why I hate the X-Men, too, right now. So the X-Men as a whole might be the answer.
Right, okay.
But because they rely on time travel and clones,
but
and
Scott.
My brother's sister is the evil cousin of my nephew, that kind of stuff, nonstop. Like, they're incestuous.
It's a mess.
It's horrible. There's actually one good New Mutants comic where Cyclops hired a psychiatrist for the X-Men, and he literally said, like, no, I realize how incestuous our relationships are. It just doesn't stop, you know? It's like, oh, the villain this week is the kind of nice clone of Magneto named Joseph, who is also a time traveler or something. And it's like, no.
That's why, I mean, I still hold on to the X-Men, but I just read one book. One book, because I don't want any of this crossover crap confusing me any more than I have suffered for the last how many 30 plus years that I've read the X-Men. I just don't even do it anymore. I just read the teen book, not uncanny, but all new. Yeah, okay. I just read the all new, and yeah, it's got the time traveling kids in it, but it's sweet, it's charming, it's missing a lot of the brutality of the older books, and I'm just staying on that safe little path with that one X-Men book.
It's gonna be canceled in about
Oh, jeez.
All right, while you deal with that, Nicole, do you have a Deadpool?
I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight.
No, I wouldn't want to say that anything is really off limits for me. It just depends on how much interest I can hold. So, like, a lot of the main guys, like, I read a lot of Bat Family, or I'll read peripheral Bat stuff, but I don't really read Batman. But I'm not opposed to Batman.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm not a big Peter Parker fan, but I like Miles Morales and Spider-Gwen and Silk and stuff. And, like, Tony Stark, like, don't really care what he's doing or where he's at. But I'd probably read a title. Like, I mean, I'm reading The Invincible Iron Man, but he's not even in it. I mean, he kind of is, but not, you know? So it's just more like the super main guys that everyone's like, oh, but this guy. And I'm like, that's cool. I'm going to go read, like, his friend down the street's title. So,
John, do you have a Deadpool? Do you have just a comic that you just absolutely, I can't read this.
My Deadpool is Deadpool as well.
See, this is why we're pals. But, this is why we get along.
But it's also because I like like you were saying, emotion and genuine feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also haven't made a great effort to read Deadpool either, so that isn't fair of me. But the stuff I have read is just, everyone's like, oh, it's great. He kicks butt and he's a wise butt. And I'm like,
we can say ass on this.
Okay. And I was like, well, those are the things that turn me off every month.
Yeah.
I just need a break from the sarcasm, you know?
Yeah. Gotcha. Cool. All right. Well, yeah, Chris.
Sorry, last one. Whenever the villain Kang shows up, I know.
Oh.
Kang.
I know.
So you like the new Avengers title?
Because this is the thing. Kang has an earlier version of himself.
It's got like 12 earlier versions.
Yeah. So he's a villain with versions.
Seriously.
And there's an older version of his name, like Immortus. There's one that's like Rama Tut. There's one that's Iron Lad. There's one that's Red Centurion or something like that. And it's just like, no.
Isn't there a Count Nefariat?
No, separate human.
Oh, yeah. Okay, all right.
So the current run of Avengers, which I think Mark Waid is writing, and Mike Del Mundo, it has a few Kangs in it.
Yeah.
And they're talking to each other.
Multiple Kangs.
There's multiple Kangs.
Like every King from every minute of time
gets
together, and there's a Council of Kings.
Yeah, and they're conspiring.
Yeah.
Rick and Morty kind of ripped that off.
Yeah. There's
Rick and Morty did it better.
Alternate reality Kings start showing up, and then Kang's like kind of good sometimes because he wants to save the time stream, because otherwise, how will we conquer it if it's not there? And you're like, this is worse than the Terminator franchise.
Time travel, right? We can just say if it's got time travel or clones, it's going to probably be messy and you're probably not going to dig it too much.
Yeah, you know, at some point when Uncanny Avengers comes out, which is the X-Men Avengers team, and Kang's the villain and Cable teleports to fight him, like, I'm done with comics.
Well, that's it. In the wise words of Peter David, I hate time travel stories. They give me intestinal cramps.
Yeah.
All right. And on that lovely note, let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And Cole Hornaday, let's start with you.
Sure. Well, I recently read Charles Burns' collected edition of his three most recent graphic novels called Last Look. And man, I love Charles Burns. So this is called actually the X'd Out Trilogy, which, and it's a trade, I will call it a trade, that compiles X'd Out, The Hive, and Sugar Skull that were published in 2010, 2012, and 2014. Now, if you are a fan of Charles Burns, you can appreciate how disciplined he was in getting these three books out with any degree of regularity. I remember reading the first one, X'd Out, and maybe The Hive, but reading them together in this compilation was a total joy. Now the story is really hard to follow, and to break it up in
that's just his way, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, to have there's no way I could have tracked it over the course of 4 years in these three separate graphic novels. In this collection, everything makes sense in a strange and surreal way. So it hops around in time, but it also hops around in our lead character Doug's dreams, and there's a fluid connection to all three of the stories when you read them in one sitting, But it was, it would have been really, really frustrating to bother with reading them separately. So you know, Doug is, many of Burns' characters are my age, and they live and grow up in sort of a suburban wood-paneled nightmare that he captures so exceptionally well. His artwork goes from being this sort of sublime, cartoony, Hergé style to imagery that I literally see in my dreams. And I just think his artwork is fascinating. The story is really intriguing, of a young man who is in love with a young woman, is a sort of a punk beat poet, leaves his first girlfriend for a second girlfriend, and then has this very series of very trippy dreams that may or may not relate to losing his father and the sort of messed up relationship he has with this girl. And then at the end of it, we hop like a good 6 years into the future and what the aftermath of all these things is. And to go any deeper into the story, I'm certain would ruin a lot of the nuance. I recommend it. Definitely not for kids. Definitely not for the I don't want to say weaker of heart, but you know, it'll play on a lot of fears, and it'll play on a lot of imagination, on your imagination. And there are aspects of this that are definitely nightmare fuel. But
Charles Burns did the Black Hole series. Yeah, so that's what some people might know him from if they don't know the X'd Out stuff.
And Black Hole was a work of genius, but again, it was another piece that I tried to read as it came out, you know, when it came out sporadically. Do you recall, was it 10 issues?
I don't know. It was collected by the time I found out about it.
And I've read the collected edition twice, still find it fascinating. And I think that Last Look is a piece of work on a par with Black Hole. I do recommend it. So this collected edition from Fantagraphics is, it's not cheap. Looking for a $29.95. However, I think it's worth it. It's color. He's got these lavish, rich inks and detailing and illustrations that go from this very open, airy imagery to tight, rough design. Love it.
All it's right.
Like $10 per collection is the way you could look at it. So it is a really nice.
It's not cheap, but it's also worth your money. How's that?
It's exactly.
A big book too.
Yeah, it's a big book.
That's three volumes in there.
So I want to get my own copy.
Last Look by Charles Burns from Fantagraphics. Thanks, Cole. All right, Chris Casso, what about you, sir?
I read The Unworthy Thor number one by Jason Aaron and Oliver Koipel. And so I do really like The Mighty Thor, but I am very behind on it. That is also Jason Aaron, and that's the one following Jane Foster.
It's still really good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I pretty much expected to be with Jason Aaron. And that's the one where Jane Foster is the wielder of the hammer, and because she is worthy.
Okay.
So this is dealing with Odin's son, who the hero formerly known as Thor, and it's him trying to kind of like cope with the fact that he's not worthy. It's a really great brother title to the main title. Fantastic artwork. He teams up with his flying goat to his master. So this is the story of a man and his goat versus some trolls. And
excellent.
If that was the whole series, that's fantastic. and Better Ray Bill shows up, and Better Ray Bill
is
one of my favorite characters. Now, there's one thing, one of the reasons I'm really interested in this, and I'll try to make it quick and share this, it's a fan theory online. So it's not really spoilers because it might not be a thing, but there's this theory that Thor is not Thor and has never been Thor. The hammer is Thor. That Odin, because Odin likes to punish people, actually trapped the essence of his son in the hammer. And when Donald Blake first picked it up, he just became what the hammer perceives a Thor to be. And the reason that actually sounds like a good theory is that the hammer over in the Mighty Thor title has a sense of character. It's moving on its own. And the whole reason that Odinson can't wield it is because someone whispered a secret to him, and it might be the secret is that he's a fake this entire time. He's a human who has the identity of Thor imprinted on him, while the hammer is truly Thor. I like that as a concept. It means that since the 60s, it works all the way back. And
was that not Nick Fury that whispered that secret message in his ear?
And the thing is, this has Nick Fury as the Unseen, because this follows Original Sin, which is now 2 years old.
Right.
Yeah.
And at the end of that, the Watcher's dead, and he was killed by Nick Fury. Spoilers. And Nick Fury becomes the new Watcher. He's damned to see time. And or see everything. And the end of Secret Wars, the ultimate Thor from the Ultimate Universe threw his hammer to the end of the reality, and it's landed in the normal Marvel Universe. So this Thor is going to be like, hey, there's a free hammer. That's not picky. And so it's very interesting. It's a neat series of sublines, subplots working through over time. So I would recommend picking this up if you already get Mighty Thor, and I would recommend getting Mighty Thor to catch up to this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. Thanks, Chris. And Nicole, what about you?
Well, speaking of brother-sister titles, I read the Black Panther World of Wakanda, and this is a title that goes into more detail with other characters that aren't Black Panther. The Black Panther title has like five different storylines going on with a lot of different characters, and one of them is the group of the Midnight Angels who descend and go on and create their own revolution. So this is written by Roxane Gay, and you know how you, Cole, were talking about how you wanted more African-American female writers in Marvel, and then we just got two more like right after that, because Roxane Gay
first.
No,
I believe.
No, I mean, like, we're getting two off of this title.
Two off of them. I think they're both technically the first Marvels ever had.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And I think Roxane is a poet. I'm not sure. Or she's the writer, another writer, like a novelist or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's also consulting with Ta-Nehisi Coates to make sure that it is a cohesive story. And the art is Athena E. Martinez. So it looks like it's all, like, Lady Run, which is really cool. This is where the Midnight Angels meet in the Dora Milaje training camp. What? Yes, that's true. Okay, so anyway, that's a really great story. And then there's a backup story about Zenzi, like, leading up to her meeting Tetu. So you get a little bit more background on the ladies of the title. And I just feel like it's really good. It's another way to expand on the universe that Ta-Nehisi is working on. And I want more. Just give me all, like, five Black Panther titles. Like, only I care about. I know, but, like, I think it's a dense enough story that you can really branch out and really play with a lot of the world.
Well, here's the question for you right now. I mean, is Wakanda going to be able to have nice things? Is there going to be peace in our time in Wakanda?
When two people find each other in a chaotic, confused world and still manage to find their true love.
Yes.
Then I think that, you know, there is potential. There is hope.
I am looking forward to reading this book.
The next step is they're
going to
vote the white ape into office. Yes. And it's just going to be downhill from there.
Are you speaking in metaphor, aren't you, brother?
Also,
that's a villain. Just an actual villain.
Yeah, you are.
Just a side note, Black Panther number 8 came out recently, and that is a pivotal issue and really, really good. So if you have been behind on your Black Panther reading, get caught up.
Mm-hmm.
That is all.
All right. Okay. Great. Thanks, Nicole.
And I am out.
That is Book Report, and coming up is quiz time. But before we do that, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything that Cole, Hornaday, and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And Comic Extension here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a review, tell us that you listened to the entire thing. The code word for today is Wakanda. If I see that in a review soon, I will send you a prize.
Yes.
All right. And
hashtag these are the jokes.
Hashtag these are the jokes. All right. So, or send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com, and get your quiz hats on, everybody, because it's quiz time. This week, our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Me?
Lay it on us, Cole.
What?
Yeah, man.
All right. Welcome to my quiz time. We're going to call this one to tell.
Built that up so much.
I know. And
then welcome to my quiz time.
I guess we're doing this now.
Yeah, precisely.
All right.
Yeah,
bring
end
it.
Of the night. So, quiz time. I've titled this one, To Tell the Truth, or Will the Real Slim Shady Please Stand Up?
Oh,
please stand up. Please stand up.
So these questions relate to actual living, breathing, authenticated inspirations for well-known comic book characters.
Hot.
Now, caveat, due to the age of many of the characters referenced, their real-world counterparts may be, like so many lessons history seeks to teach us, lost in the sands of time and to the ears of some listeners. First up, created by Joe Siegel and Jerry Schuster, in 1933, Superman's bespeckled and meek alter ego Clark Kent was based on this nebbishy silent film star.
A nebbishy
silent film star.
I'm just going to go ahead and say Harold Lloyd.
You are absolutely right, Mr. Lawrence. You are absolutely right. Harold Lloyd died in 1971 after having made over 200 silent films and talkies, the popularity of which rivaled Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
Next, unlike the nonviolent leader of the X-Men, Professor Charles Xavier, Eric Lenscher, a.k.a. Magneto, former leader of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, advocated intimidation, conflict, and violence to combat human intolerance for mutant kind. Who was Magneto based on?
Malcolm X.
Malcolm X is correct. Born 1925, was assassinated in 1965. Malcolm X, so it's an African-American leader and prominent figure of the Nation of Islam, who articulated concepts of race pride and black nationalism in the 1950s and 60s. To quote Stan Lee, "I did not think of Magneto as a bad guy. He was trying to strike back at people who were bigoted and racist. He was trying to defend mutants, and because society was not treating them fairly, he decided to teach society a lesson. He was a danger, of course, but I never thought of him as a villain." And one of my favorite Malcolm X quotes is, "If you don't stand for something, you will fall for anything." Next, wealthy inventor, industrialist, and unapologetic playboy Tony Stark, a.k.a. Iron Man, was based on what wealthy inventor and industrialist turned casino tycoon of the Cold War era?
Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes is correct. Born in 1905, died in 1976, Hughes was at one time considered one of the most financially successful people in the world. He died an obsessive, paranoid recluse, supposedly only having his hair and nails cut once a year, and purportedly keeping the latter in jars. A fine example of the opportunities wealth, material wealth, will afford one in this life.
Ugh.
Though it's unclear who exactly can be credited for Gotham's city, though it's unclear who can exactly be credited for the creation of Gotham City's public enemy number one, the Joker, Bob Kane, Bill Finger, or Jerry Robinson, all three creators point a finger in the direction of this silent film star.
I don't know the name, but I know what you're talking about.
Because it's the man who laughs.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. John, what do you got?
A man who laughs.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Okay. You are right there. You are right there.
German?
German?
Yes.
Conrad?
Yes.
Schlitzenberg?
No. Think of Ozymandias.
Veidt.
Excellent. German actor Conrad Veidt in his role of Gwynplaine in the 1928 silent classic The Man Who Laughs.
Terrifying.
Yeah. I've never seen it, but you look at the image of it and that's... coming down to the last question, and I'm actually going to go for the one that I chose later and not go with the one I chose prior. In crafting the streetwise working class mage John Constantine as a supporting character in Swamp Thing, Alan Moore based the Hellblazer on what frontman from that successfully synchronous trio of the 1980s?
Successfully synchronous trio?
With one breath, with one flow.
Oh, yes.
You will know synchronicity.
I will kill you.
I will kill him.
I thought you were talking about the Beastie Boys at one point.
No, synchronicity. Sting, a.k.a. Gordon Sumner, born 1951. One could further argue Constantine's bleach blonde hair and beige trench coat were actually borrowed from Sting's look in the film Brimstone and Treacle from 1987. And that is the Cole Hornaday Quiz.
All right. Well, thank you, Cole Hornaday. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Nicole and Chris and Cole and John for joining us for these last 3 weeks.
You can finally go home now.
It's so good to be with us.
All right.
You are released from your contract.
That is...
Fly, man. Be free.
That is our show. Thank you for sticking with us. Again, the code word is Wakanda. We'll see you next week.
Wakanda out.